Now, here I come to the Balfour Declaration. I may say I'm extremely critical myself of the Balfour Declaration. I mentioned just now in an aside that I was, as a young man, working for the British government during the First World War on the Turkish Empire, which at that time, of course, included Palestine. So I had certain inside knowledge of what happened at that time. I'm critical of the Balfour Declaration, and I'm still more critical of the conduct of the British Mandate during the next 30 years, because I think we never took a line or made up our mind one way or the other, and that was, I think, extremely hard on both the Jews and the Arabs. But anyway, the Balfour Declaration, it's central to this point of title. You know, it's a short document. Many of you probably know it by heart. I can't remember the exact words, but there are two sentences, really, it consists of. The first is, Britain undertakes to uphold and support a Jewish national home in Palestine. The second clause is, provided that nothing is done to harm the interests of the existing inhabitants of the country, which at the time the declaration was made in 1917, were more than 90% Arabs, of course. And I blame the Balfour Declaration because the word home was vague, but it was made very clear, as I know directly from seeing the documents at the time, as a young temporary official in the British Foreign Office, that it was made perfectly clear and was accepted by Dr. Weizmann at the time that home did not mean state, because if home meant state, then the first clause of the Balfour Declaration would have been incompatible with the second clause in it, which was equally an obligation of equal power and validity, equally incumbent on the British government who made the declaration, that no harm should be done to the rights and interests of the existing inhabitants of the country. I do think that, I suppose everybody would think that the Jews had a claim to a national home, but I do think that that national home could not, without detriment to the detriment we've seen, 900,000 refugees, to the interests of the existing inhabitants of the country, take the form of an exclusively Jewish state. It might have taken the form of a Palestinian state which included both Jews and Arabs on a footing of equality. You might say that was a theoretical possibility, and once the country had been open to Jewish immigration on terms cited not by the existing population themselves, but by the British government, the situation was going eventually to get out of hand. All regimes and peoples in Palestine since AD 135 have tolerated and recognized the right of Jews to live in Palestine. They've always at Jerusalem been pious Jews studying the law in this place, which is the most sacred place for Jews in the world, and Turkish regime tolerated that. I don't know what the Crusaders did. If anybody didn't tolerate it, probably the Crusaders, but I don't care about that. But throughout history on the whole, that has been so. Now, the national home was the enlargement of that, studying the law by about 50,000 Jews there counted in Jerusalem at the time, and about 12,000 agricultural settlers, I think, in 1917. That was rather an old-fashioned form of Jewish national home, and the intention of I think the Zionist movement, as led by Dr. Weizmann, and of the British government, as represented by Mr. Balfour, was to broaden the basis and to modernize the Jewish national home by allowing more immigration, letting the Jews have the right, as of right, within limited numbers to settle in Palestine. Limited numbers because of this other obligation Great Britain had undertaken not to harm the interests of the existing inhabitants of the country. Have a university, have all the apparatus of modern civilization. Now, I blame the Balfour Declaration from this sense, that I think a lawyer could prove that the two obligations undertaken in it were compatible, but perhaps it's only hindsight. Perhaps you can't blame British government at the time too much for not having foreseen this at the moment, though I do blame them all the same. Both communities were going to interpret this in ways that were incompatible with each other. Palestine has entered the so-called A class, which were to be prepared for self-government and complete sovereign independence. The Arabs, being more than 90%, naturally thought that when Palestine became independent, it would be an Arab state with a Jewish minority. The Jews, or some of the Jews, was great controversy among different branches of Zionists and other Jews over this. interpreted the national home as merely a kind of halfway house towards the Jewish state. And some, I'm afraid, said even if that's not what the British meant, we're going to use this as a lever for having a Jewish state in the end. Very human, I'm not blaming them too much for that. But anyway, I myself think that the Balfour Declaration was right in putting this limitation. You may say it's like the pound of flesh and the drop of blood in the Merchant of Venice, that if there was to be no detriment to the interests of the 90% non-Jewish existing population, you couldn't have much of a Jewish home. You could have a cultural one, but you certainly couldn't have a political one. I think that was the conditions were accepted by the Zionist organization at the time and were laid down by the British, and which gave the Jews something that was very near their heart's desire and on paper, safeguard the interests of the existing inhabitants of the country, which on all grounds of law and morality one should do.
On the statute of limitations, which has a certain legal connotation, it also has in this context a connotation history. I'd like to quote you, Professor. In your study you say the Jews live on the same peculiar people long after Phoenicians and the Philistines lost their identity like all the nations. The ancient Syriac neighbors of Israel have fallen into the melting pot and have been reminted in the fullness of time with new images and superscriptions, while Israel has proved impervious to this alchemy performed by history in the crucibles of universal states and universal churches and wanderings of the nations. Extremely eloquent description, if I may say so, of Jewish survival. This statute of limitations was not recognized by history. We are the only people today in the Middle East speaking the same language, practicing the same religious faith, living in the same category of aspiration, spiritual continuity, as our forefathers thousands of years ago, as those who were exiled from there. There's nobody else from 132 of the Common Era in that category, in terms of continuity.
Well, it was, Mr. Ambassador, recognized by history, wasn't it, in this very practical sense that...
the Balfour Declaration.
No, that by 1917... more than 90% of the population of Palestine were not Jews. That is the work of history de facto. Another work of history de facto is the continuing memory of the Jews of Palestine and their memory of Palestine and their hope for a return. But the Balfour Declaration, he takes account of both these.
Yes, I appreciate that. Yeah. On the question of historical association.
Yeah.
You recognize, Professor, that there was a continuous Jewish residence in the land of Israel.
Yeah.
The return became the goal of the national life down the ages. It is also a fact that the Arabs never had Palestine as a separate political entity. It was controlled from remote caliphates for a number of centuries. It passed from hand to hand, 13 conquests down the ages. As the Middle East came to life, in terms of the development of new nations, a process beginning after World War I, which has continued to our time and was consummated in the 40s and early 50s. The international consciousness recognized that the Arab peoples deserve nationhood and deserve independence, deserve to achieve independence from the torpor of centuries and conquest.
Yeah.
And 8 Arab states came into being, covering an area close to 2 million square miles. They've achieved independence, a status without precedent, possibly even in the golden days of the Caliphate. Within that category of the Middle East, it was recognized that the Jewish people, having longed and lived for its return, should establish itself once again independence and freedom in the land of Israel. Now, you have an interpretation, sir, of the Balfour Declaration based on your association work at the time, British government. But surely you will acknowledge that Lord Balfour himself, Lloyd George, Prime Minister of the government, Winston Churchill, surely they should know what was meant by the Balfour Declaration, and they have clearly stated so down the years. And indeed, Amir Faisal, whom you met at the peace conference, he too recognized implicitly in his whole approach.
Not the Jewish state.
Well, I haven't got the pact here, but it's certainly implicit. But in any event, those responsible for the Balfour Declaration have clearly defined its purpose. There's talks there of religious and civil rights of other inhabitants, and on that there's never been any question. But the basic issue here is The Arab peoples, having achieved a patrimony over 8 countries and independence, millions of square miles, should not begrudge the Jewish people a state of 8,000 square miles which can work in peace and cooperation with them. Now, originally, the mandate related to both Palestine and Transjordan. In 1921, 4/5 was cut off and Jordan became independent. Well, developed independence, the Emirate of Transjordan. So you had a further attempt to satisfy the Arab approach. And so over the years, the situation developed as it did. Now, if you look at it today, we hold neither land nor resource, water, any other resource, which our Arab neighbors need for survival or advancement. Only blessing can come from cooperation, not only for us, also for them. But history has set certain principles in the approach to the whole problem of the Middle East. We have, down the ages, prayed and believed that our restoration would come, that independence would be restored, that within that context of independence, we again could make a contribution to mankind. This has taken place in our time. We believe that there are among Arab circles people who subconsciously appreciate this. But they've got to be encouraged. Any attempt to raise old claims without relevance to the present situation, and we'll talk later on of the future, I think are very helpful in that regard. We can either pass now, sir, to the fossil business or...
Yes. Mr. Ambassador, if I may take up this last point. The provinces of Canada stretch even further than the 8 Arab countries. They stretch from ocean to ocean. So surely on the ambassador's argument, Canada should not begrudge to the poor of Algonquin such a little piece as, say, Montreal, because they've got such an awful lot left, even if Montreal was given back to the Algonquins. I'm putting it in a joking form, but my serious point is that the fact that those 8 Arab countries are happily independent does not affect the fate of the Arabs who lived in what is now Israel, because that is not part of the Arab states. And the fact that other Arabs have their independence and can make their own future does not make the former Arab inhabitants of what is now Israel any less refugees and expatriates than they are at the moment. On the Balfour Declaration, I must say explicitly that I know that it was clearly understood at the time that the national home was not intended to be a Jewish national state. And this was clearly stated to the Zionist organization by the British government at the time that the Balfour Declaration was issued. And the declaration was accepted on those terms, and the mandate was given by the League of Nations to Britain on those terms. I think Britain made an awful mess of the administration's mandate. I think we had taken on something perhaps beyond the capacity of any country to take on. Never mind. The Jews could not have made the mistake at the time of believing that the Balfour Declaration promised them a Jewish state.
But it is a fact, Professor. I say that I've read the interpretations given by those responsible for the declaration.
Yes.
And the consensus of world opinion of the time and the unfolding years after that. But certainly you will agree that the United Nations took a decision in November 1947 that there was to be a Jewish state in Palestine.
And they took a decision later that the Arab refugees were to be repatriated
into
Israel.
They did not take such a decision, sir.
No.
They did not take a decision that the Arab refugees had to be repatriated to Israel. And we can discuss this now if you wish, or go on with the fossil business.
I'd like to discuss that, yes.
Very good.
Yes.
The General Assembly of the United Nations, 1948, established a Palestine Conciliation Commission to deal with the whole complex of problems which had arisen between Israel and the Arab states. They were to serve as mediators, and the parties were also asked in the resolution if they wished to go operate directly, in terms of direct contact, with a view to finding a solution of all these problems. Within the context of this resolution, the refugee problem is referred to. The commission is supposed to study the possibilities either of repatriation or of resettlement or of compensation. but all this in part of a general context of a peace settlement. The resolution talks of return of refugees as soon as practicable, and it also talks of those refugees who wish to live in peace. This resolution has been dead now since 1948.
Dead.
It has been dead, yes, it has been dead, because the Arabs have never announced that they would live in peace with Israel. They refused to negotiate directly. And the PCC, in fact, has been a defunct body for many years now. Now, what is our position on this? The Arab refugee problem, Professor, is one of a whole complex of refugee problems. I believe that since 1940, some 35 million people have been uprooted across the world.
Yes.
Korea and Vietnam, Germany, Finland.
Yes.
Nearly all of these problems either have been solved or approaching solution. And in no case has the solution been through repatriation, but rather through absorption. Now, what have we said? We have said that we are prepared to pay full compensation. We have said we are prepared to consider a limited repatriation within a framework, reunion of families, but the problem will never move unless the Arab governments are prepared to cooperate in alleviating the suffering of the refugees. And the fact is, our figures, by the way, of the refugees are about 550,000. We have basis to assume that some 160,000 have been absorbed. This is a unique problem. There's no economic difficulty. Money has been voted by the United Nations as a promise of the United States government for international loan. There's no social problem because they're living among their people. The Arab living today in a camp in Transjordan, he's not a Pole living in Britain. He's living in his own surroundings, part of the environment of a rising Arab nationalism, religious, cultural, identity of background. And psychological. The problem will never move until the Arab governments are prepared to cooperate in a humanitarian solution. I notice, Professor, that you yourself have criticized the Arab governments.
I have, yes.
And you have said very rightly, and talking of suffering, referring back to our first part of the conversation, why don't they take them out of this parasitic existence? Why don't they set them up in farms and in villages and homes? Why keep them there as a political weapon? You who scan history over thousands of years, do you know of any other case, any precedent of holding hundreds of thousands of people as political hostage in camps, parasitic, no future, quenching the very sense of creativeness in them? For what purpose? So they can be ready as part of political pawn for some ultimate program to exterminate Israel, God forbid. Is that more? Is that an approach? Have you read the Secretary General of the United Nations, his report last year? He views the solution in terms of economic integration to the area. We will, of course, will play our part in it. We are very upset at this continued humanitarian problem. But it's not within our hands. We can't solve it. In Israel now, there are 10% Arabs, 200,000. They enjoy every right with their fellow Jewish citizens. Do you want us to take back people who've been nurtured on hate for 13 years on the basis of a resolution of 1948 talking of those wishing to live in peace, nurtured on hate and vengeance and destruction, take them back into our state when we have 10% Arab population? For what? They can rip us apart? They should be schizophrenic? Take them out of a total Arab environment where they live, where they can create economically, socially, religiously, but psychologically part, bring them in to be a minority in a Jewish state, and this will help the problem of the Middle East. There is money, there is land, there is water. All that is needed is a part of that humanitarian benevolence and sense of duty to which you referred. Professor Toynbee, in 1948, the war of aggression unleashed on us created two refugee problems. One related to some 550,000 Arabs. The other related to some 400,000 Jews and 70,000 Arabs. We have settled the second problem. We've absorbed over 400,000 Jews from Arab countries who were there of longer standing than the same Arabs in Palestine. We've settled them, we've taken them in as brothers, and we have settled 70,000 Arab refugees in the country. The only Arab refugees which have been struck off from UNRWA rolls are those which we have taken into our economy. The other problem has not moved, not because there's no money, not because there's no possibility, but purely because a humanitarian problem is being given, put into a totally political context of animosity and hatred. And the feelings of these poor people and their future, their very life, is being sacrificed on what? Some demagogic ambition of control and rule throughout the Middle East. Every international assessment of it, every report, has recommended a movement in the direction of economic integration, of broadening economic possibilities, and we will play our part. There's no question on that. We long to see the problem solved as you do, but it will not be solved by formulas, will not be solved within a context where they refuse to talk to us, will not be solved when these refugees are being prepared to destroy us. Only a few months ago, last month, Professor Toynbee, a representative of the Arab refugees appeared at the United Nations. What did he speak about? The destruction of Israel, the extermination of Israel. He was probably told to do so by a certain government in the Middle East. He said so. So you tell us now, 48 they talked of coming back in peace. Now take them back after 13 years and he says he wants to destroy you. Why not? Let him come in and rip you apart. Please commit suicide. So at least the Arab armies won't have to overwhelm you from without. That, sir, I think in the scan of history you will find no nation has been prepared to do. And since you said earlier that in certain respects we belong to a whole category of nations, in our behavior, in this respect too, we will not commit suicide.
I think there are two points in what the ambassador has said. One is repatriation, and the other is using refugees as pawns. I think there is an inconsistency in the Israeli stand. You claim for Jews repatriation into Palestine, though it's long ago as 135 AD, there's been no solid Jewish population in Palestine, though I agree with the ambassador, there always have been Jews in Palestine as a minority, rather small minority. And those since, I think, 63 or 64 BC haven't been a Jewish state in Palestine. And you've claimed repatriation not in the terms of the Balfour Declaration, a Jewish national home, but not a state, but in the extreme form of a state. But at the same time, you deny to the Arabs who were forced out of Palestine, of the Israeli part of Palestine, as recently as 1948, the very thing that you claim as the central claim of the Jewish people. That is inconsistent. Then think about it.